This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Radio is everywhere.
Always accurate and precise.
Bloomberg's really one of the places that's reporting facts.
Your communication capabilities are wonderful for our business.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini. On this weekend edition of Bloomberg Best,
Bank of America's Brian Moynihan's list of what to do to be ready for a mild recession.
Test to make sure you see at the margin you can move things around. Manage your expenses very carefully and really make sure you're shaping your headcount the way you want.
Jim Paulson of Luthold Group says we're starting a new easing cycle and the Fed will soon halt the hikes.
They're going to have to be wrapping it up pretty soon.
But Joyce Chang of J.P. Morgan says don't count on a Fed pivot for a while.
Recessionary risk in the U.S. rising towards the end of 2023.
And Derek Jeter on his trading card business, Arena Club.
The trading card industry would almost seem like it was a secret society.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the week. Powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
Ed, banks, of course, are very vulnerable potentially to economic downturns.
Of course. And Brian Moynihan, chairman and CEO at Bank of America, tells Bloomberg's Shanali Basak his bank, for one, is preparing for a mild recession.
And here's Moynihan with Shanali on the sidelines of the Goldman Sachs U.S. Financial Services Conference. Let's listen in.
Brian, thank you so much. You know, you've been talking so much now about this idea next year of a mild recession. When you're preparing Bank of America for the year ahead, what does that preparation look like for a mild recession?
Well, the preparation is from the many years of responsible growth, how we built the portfolios, how we built the business, what businesses we do and what businesses we don't do, how we shaped our exposures, how we stress test our exposures on a, you know, every quarter, every month, every week. And so there's not a lot you can do today to change what's going to happen in the next 6 months, because we have portfolios that are built over years and years. And so what can you do near term? Test to make sure you see at the margin you can move things around. Manage your expenses very carefully and really make sure you're shaping your headcount the way you want. And we've been working on that. Continue to invest in efficiency and effectiveness, but also continuing to spend money where you have competitive advantage. So we're still hiring new relationship managers in business banking, commercial banking, new financial advisors, private bankers, people in the branches. We invest $600 million more in marketing this year than we did back then, because the opportunity is still there. But we've got to be careful about how you do all that and make it work for everybody, including shareholders.
When you think about what could potentially move that mild recession into a deeper recession, what are the specific risk factors that are on the back of your mind?
Well, there's risk factors external to the U.S., things like the escalation of the war in Russia, Ukraine, in a way that people aren't anticipating. People are saying it's going on. It just doesn't get a lot different or worse. A change in around Taiwan, China-U.S. relationships around Taiwan or whatever. Those types of external factors could change it. European consumption is another big consumption pot in the world's being. And free travel to Europe and moving around and stuff helps the world's economy. So that's what you got to worry. In the United States, we are a consumer-led economy. Consumer spend. The spending by the consumers of Bank of America is up over last year, but the rate of which it is up, it is bigger than it was last year. It's bigger this month than it was in November than it was in October. Bigger in October and September. So it's not stopping or slowing down. It's just growing at less rate. So it grew at 3% during the Thanksgiving to Cyber Monday. It grew 3% over last year. A record amount spent, 5% for the month of November. But year to date, it's 11%. So what does that mean? From 11% year to date to 5% in the current month, that means it's slowing down a little bit. So that's going to be about the consumer. Are they spending? If they're spending, businesses make money, businesses, hotels, restaurants, travel, et cetera, is open. And if you watch that consumer spending pattern, a little less on big things and a lot more on experiences.
So over to the investment banking side of things, a lot of the industry is starting culling. They're starting job cuts again. Do you think that given the drop off we've seen in the business, industry wide, frankly, do you think that this is the time that there will be some cuts, especially among people who are not performing?
We, in our industry, investment banking is one business of the many businesses we have. And in that business, it has a higher volatility to the revenues that they achieve in a given year. And so you've read the stories about compensation, all that stuff. It has to happen. The revenues are way down. But we take a different attitude. We know we can absorb those teammates. We by just manage our headcount carefully. So what do we do in times like like this, you look at your open positions, you look at your fill rate, which is how many people hire as a percentage of people leave, and you shape the headcount back in across the whole company. We take some of the talent, teammates, investment banking, and bring them into other parts of the company at times like this. We did our CFO, Alistair Borthwick, former investment banker. Our last CFO, Paul D'Onofrio, former investment banker. Our CFO before that, Bruce Thompson, a former investment banker. So we're always absorbing, and that's just the top of the house, but we absorb so many people out of those businesses. And so, yeah, other people, because they're more monoline, don't have as broader franchise, might make adjustments. But by the way, there's parts of our investment bank that are growing nicely, and our market share is still number three. But in our middle market company investment banking, we're investing in that, so we'll move some of the people to help in that business. So everybody's focused on that, but the reality is you can manage a headcount if you just get ahead of it and start working on it.
On the talent war, David Solomon over at Goldman Sachs had told me that he was surprised by how sticky the talent war is. But there are headwinds. How do you feel?
Well, I'll give you a simple example. In the early months this year, we were hiring 4,000 people. We had 4,000 people leave us, and because of the bid in the market, for lack of it, not investment banking, but the whole company, and we have 200 some thousand people. And now we're down to about 2,000. And so you think about that difference. Now, 2,000 a month, those 6,000 for a quarter, maintain the same headcount, we got to hire 6,000 people. So we're out there bidding in the market every day. We just have that more equilibrium. Because back then, we were hiring 2,000 against 4,000 leaving. Now we're hiring, then we got to hiring 4,000 against 3,000 leaving, and now it's down to 2,000, so we had to slow down the hiring. So I think it really depends on what business and what area and what you're doing. But, there's still talent. We seek talent all the time. We bring them in the company. We're just more careful about it in times like this. Because frankly, we have great talent, and we want to make sure we can pay them and promote them and give them opportunity. And so we want to take care of our own first, and that's the principle.
Consumers here are facing, yes, higher interest rates, trying to combat inflation here to really make this economic picture more sustainable. But what about when it comes to savings rates? At what point, is there a general timeline for Bank of America where savings rates will start to go higher for consumers?
Well, the saving rates were high, then came down, and that was based on consumption and things like that. What you see in our deposit balances is year over year they're up about 10% for, say, median income households and down. They're still up, but they're starting to deplete them. So they were at a level, they went up to a peak in April after tax returns came in, and they've been flattish around, and now they're starting to go down a little bit. That's a glass half full, half empty. For the individual consumer, they're starting to consume a little bit more money. That is good for the question of whether the Fed's actions are slowing down the economy, and is it time for them to think about when they stop and when they let it work for a while. That debate's raging every day in the markets, but the evidence shows that, yes, the economy is being slowed by the higher interest rates, by the fact that the inflation is eating up more of a person's savings. They need to get that under control. That means higher interest rates, but on the other hand, you're seeing them slow down, which ought to put less price pressure. That means they could slow down, so that's going to be the debate. I think we need a few more months to see whether it's just a trend or not, but right now the deposit balance on our customers have held steady. They're starting to come down a hair in those below median income households. And again, but very strong. It's multiples of pre-pandemic. That's the people.
Well, the other area that higher interest rates really starts to impact is the housing market. There are a lot of fears. You're even starting to see some bankruptcies among some smaller lenders here. So when you look at, from your perch, the mortgage market at large, do you have any real worry that we can go off the deep end a little bit more here?
So you need to separate two different things. So in terms of America, there's about 130-odd million households. About 60 have a mortgage. All those people are locked in, 90% below 5%, 80% below 4%, 50% below 3%. Their payments don't go up. They're fixed rate. So now the question on the other part, what affects them is rents. Rents were going up quickly after they fell from 20 to 21, then they came back up. Now they're starting to, the last 3 months they've been down every month, higher than they've ever been. They're always down a little bit in this part of the year. That means it's starting to tip over. Not everywhere. Midwestern rents are higher. These coastal rents are dropping off. But that's a good news from in terms of getting inflation under control. Now you go to the new house purchase market. Obviously that came way down because the cost of debt went from 3 to 6. 3 to 6 changes your ability to buy. People step back and say, I want to be more careful. I've got to save more if I want to make this all work. That caused it. So what happened? Housing prices will tip down. But you got to go back and think about where we were in 19. Housing prices shot up and they're going to go back down and they're going to get more on a line of long-term growth. By the the way, exactly what happened in the financial crisis. So we got to be careful about, we're working off a funny base year now, because you had such an explosion after we could go back out and buy houses and things. You know, people moved back to cities for rents. Now you're seeing that come back out of the system. That is what the Fed is trying to achieve, is to slow down the rate of wealth created in housing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't affect 60 million American households have a mortgage, don't change their monthly cost. It's the other group that is affected by it.
Before I let you go, we're almost at the end of the year, almost 1 year ago, over at Bank of America, you made a huge change in leadership. It was a very large change. You had said at the time that you can see yourself at the helm for another 10 years. Yeah. Do you still see that being the case, or has anything changed?
Well, we have the interesting thing. As a CEO, you have to have this long view, and I expect to run this company for as long as the board will let me, but they have a day-to-day contract. They can let me go tomorrow. That's the way it works. It's there's no contracts. There's no protection. We live day-to-day like anybody else, but we have to have this long-term view. I expect I'm going to do this job. It's the best job in the world for as long as they'll have me, and I've told them I can continue to do it for a good period of time. You know, the changes we made in management, the new team has come together well and performing well. You know, Tom and Ann are on to a new venture something to do, which is important to work we do in carbon trading and with TPG and others investing, and in fact us investing in it, and others are doing other things. But that's natural ebb and flow of life. As people have worked together for 13 years, some of us get a little older because they start a little older. Others are going to get older over the next decade, and we'll see how it all plays out. But you know, my job is to do a good job, and hopefully the board will keep me there.
That was Brian Moynihan, Chairman and CEO at Bank of America, with Bloomberg's Shanali Basak on the sidelines at the Goldman Sachs U.S. Financial Services Conference.
And coming up, some are worried about a dip in the stock market, but not Jim Paulson of Luthold Group.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
Denise, the Fed is gearing up for the December FOMC meeting and another interest rate hike.
And they are widely expected, Ed, to keep raising rates, although possibly at a slower pace than the previous hikes.
Now, Joyce Chang, chair of global research at J.P. Morgan, tells Bloomberg's Danny Berger that even though she sees more economic weakness ahead, she doesn't think a Fed pivot is coming anytime soon.
So we've always thought that the fears of a near-term recession are overdone. I mean, looking at U.S. growth in the third quarter at close to 3%, still 1.5% in the fourth quarter, I think that a pause at the end of the first quarter, lower inflation, this disinflation trade, all of that has happened very quickly. I worry more about the recession risk in late 2023, when you see really more of the weight of unemployment going up, the weight of 500 basis points of Fed hikes, and that U.S. growth is also coming down at that point. So we look at this much more as a late 2023 risk, whereas a lot of the good news that's front-loaded for 2023 seems to be happening before year-end. We're at a lot of some of the forecasts we're forecasting for the end of 2023 almost right now.
So we're doing it way too early, Joyce. And but the rally, if the assumption is that the rally is happening because the Fed pivots because these things happen earlier, I wonder if even that in itself is folly, because presumably if the Fed is pivoting this time around, it's not for a good reason. It's a deteriorating fundamental picture. I mean, is that really a reason to be buying risk?
Well, I think it's premature to say that there is a Fed pivot. I mean, we saw another 100 basis points of Fed tightening to go. And then the question is it a pause? Is it really something that I would call a high hold, not a pivot? And I do think that that's really more the scenario that we see with recessionary risk in the U.S. rising towards the end of 2023.
And that was Joyce Chang, chair of global research at J.P. Morgan, with Bloomberg's Danny Berger.
On the other hand, Jim Paulson, chief investment strategist at Luthold Group, says a new easing cycle has already begun.
And Ed, he tells our Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz there are really a bunch of reasons why he's convinced that's true. Let's listen in.
Well, Jonathan, I the Fed is not the only policy driver in the room. There are others, and a lot of those have already started to ease, I think, and they don't hold press conferences, but it still matters. And I think, you know, if you go through the list here, we still have the Fed. They're going to raise rates again. But if you look at what the bond market's doing, everything even from 2 years out, they're all easing. We got the ease in the 10-year. Mortgage rates are coming down as well on the long end. That matters. That matters immediate support for stocks, but also longer term for the economy. Fiscal juice, if you look at federal deficit to GDP ratio, that's rising again after going down for months, almost 18 months. It's starting to prove again as economy slows, tax receipts slow, automatic expenditures go up, and fiscal juice expands. The dollar's starting to ease after a tightening for all of this year. And that matters certainly too overall. And then you get into things like companies. Look at what companies are dealing with. They're seeing industrial commodity prices that have come down 20-25%. They're seeing unit labor costs decelerating. They're seeing capital costs coming down. So everything from commodity to capital cost to labor cost are easing for companies. Look at the consumer. They're seeing gas prices at the pump fall from over $5 to heading towards $3. The real wage rate has risen 3.2% annualized pace now in the last 5 months. As inflation is moderated, real wages are rising again for the household sector. You look at credit spreads, junk spreads or mortgage spreads, they're starting to tighten again, which is, again, an easing mechanism, if you will. So I really think there's quite a bit of early cycle easing, and I think the Fed's story is about over too. I think they're just getting increasingly out of bounds, raising rates with falling commodity prices, raising rates with decelerating headline inflation rates, raising rates with decelerating unit labor cost, raising rates in a slowing economy. I think they're going to have to be wrapping it up pretty soon.
So, Jim, what's your S&P target for next year? Is it 6,000? Is it 5,000? I mean, this seems like a very bullish scenario that goes against a lot of consensus.
Well, you know, Lisa, I think that if you think the bear market is not over, I get that, and that's one thing. I think the lows are in, and I think we're starting a new bull market. And new bull markets don't go up 7 to 10% in year one. They go up 25, 35% in year one. That's what new bull markets do. And I kind of think if we avoid recession, which I still think the odds favor, maybe 60-40 that we do, or if we have a modest recession, that the stock market is into a new bull market. In the first year of bulls, earnings don't do well at all. They're generally flat. They're often down. But what really happens is multiples go way up. And I look back since 1990, the first year of bull markets, the average trailing PE multiple rises by 35%. On average. And if I look at, let's say earnings go to $220 or even $215 in the next year, but the multiple goes from its low at the bear market low of around 17 up to 22 or 23 times, it gets me to around 5,000. And I don't think that's all that unreasonable. I'm very interested that the strategist on the street, their forecaster are virtually no gain at all over the next year. And I don't remember, there's not a lot of years when people are looking out, strategists are usually optimistic, that they're pessimistic. And I think if that's wrong and we are past the bear and we have a modest or no recession and starting a new bull, I think the returns could be really pretty phenomenal, something around 5,000 in the coming 12 months.
Wow. Jim, you're a student of market history. Can you tell me how rare it would be to make a low in the equity market this far ahead of a recession that we still haven't had?
Well, I look back at this going back to 1945. I think there's been 11 recessions, Jonathan. And I look back at what was the response of the stock market during each cycle prior to the beginning of a recession. And so from the S&P 500, from its cycle high for the month right ahead of the start of the recession, how much had the stock market responded to recession risk? And the median response of those previous 11 was 5.5% decline from its cycle high. Here in this cycle, we're already down more than 25% from the cycle high. That's how much we already adjusted for a pending recession. So I think that part of the fallout, if you will, from a recession is already in the stock market. And so even if we have one, I'm not so sure that necessarily means it has to go down. I'd also say I don't ever remember another time when the CEOs in this country are almost 100% universal that we're going to have recession. Usually recessions are something that comes out of left field and it surprises the market. That's not going to happen here. People already have it in the market. So I think it's a very different situation overall. The same thing with yield curves. I've looked at that. Inverted yield curves, which lead to recessions, and we could get one here. But the fact of the matter is the negative fallout for the stock market depends on when the curve inverts. And the ones that turn out bad for stocks is when the curve inverts and the stock market is near its high for the cycle. This curve inverted in October when the stock market was already off 25%. And when that happens, the stock market does okay. And so we'll see what happens. But I'm more on the side that there's too much pessimism, too much has already been discounted, and that opens the door for a positive surprise and people have to catch up.
That was Jim Paulson, Chief Investment Strategist at the Luthold Group, with Bloomberg's Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz.
And coming up, Ed, is it time to risk investing in debt?
You are listening to Bloomberg Best.
Broadcasting live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York. Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C. Bloomberg 991. To Boston. Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco. Bloomberg 960. To the country. Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe. The Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Best.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini. Ed, probably doesn't take a genius to figure out that the commercial real estate business is facing some headwinds.
Yeah, right. Like higher interest rates and a bunch of empty offices.
Mm-hmm. And a correction in commercial real estate is coming, according to Anastasia Amoroso, Chief Investment Strategist at iCapital.
And she also tells Bloomberg's Jonathan Farrow, do not panic about recent stories about client redemptions at places like Blackstone.
This is an industry trend, and there's two stories to this. There's the redemption story, why redemption's rising, and then there's the limit on redemption story. And what I would say about redemptions, it should not really be a surprise to anybody that investors want to redeem. Because if you look at commercial real estate and the performance of it in the first half of the year, it's been rock solid. It's up 9%, while the 60-40 portfolio is down 16%. So if that happens, it means your commercial real estate exposure might actually be a little bit out of balance and over and above the allocation limit. So investors move to right-size their allocations because of how well commercial real estate has performed. But there's the other side of this, which is we know the environment is likely to weaken for commercial real estate in the next couple of quarters. So I think some investors move to lock in gains because they expect the depreciation. So that's the redemption story. So it's expected, and I don't think there's really anything earth-shattering about that. The second part of this is limits on redemptions. And I truly believe it is in the investor's best interest because these are semi-liquid, non-traded REIT products that the underlying is illiquid commercial real estate. Imagine if there are no limits on redemptions and if everybody could redeem, what are the fund managers to do? They would have to sell all those underlying commercial real estate properties and that would cause more of a negative feedback loop. So the fact that there are limits on redemptions, I would say, is actually a very good thing and kind of breaks this negative feedback loop cycle and it protects the investors that are staying in the fund. And by the way, none of these products right now are struggling with performance per se, and none of them are not paying distributions. They're paying income out to their investors. So I think, you know, a lot of kind of the negative sentiment about the limits and redemptions is overdone, and this is in the best interest of investors.
Do you think we can ultimately avoid fast sales? Is this sufficient?
I think some assets will have to be sold. You know, I don't think there's avoiding that. But I do think that if you look at the space of non-traded REITs in general, a lot of the products there, rightfully so, have put limits in place in case they do see redemption. So that in of itself should prevent us from having mass fire sales of commercial real estate property. But having said that, I think there's some challenges for commercial real estate in the next couple of quarters. You know, we've seen the reset in rates, but we've not seen a reset in cap rates, for example. And if you look at the cap rate on multifamily, for example, it's 4.5%, and it's rock bottom levels. I don't think it's going to incentivize investors to step into the sector until those cap rates move higher. And I think that happens at some point. You know, the other thing that's likely to happen for commercial real estate is the NOI growth, the net operating income growth, is likely to slow down, you know, from 7 or 8% to probably 4% next year, assuming there's no recession. I think we should assume there is a recession, so it's likely going to be slower. So I think we're going to have a correction in real estate prices in the coming quarters. But here lies an opportunity for investors. I think the right move is you stick with some of the exposure. You get the income, because a big theme for us has been get paid while you wait, all this volatility in the equity markets. And then when we've seen the reset in property prices, you step back in and add more to those real estate portfolios.
And that was Anastasia Amoroso, Chief Investment Strategist at iCapital, sharing her thoughts about a possible correction in commercial real estate with Bloomberg's Jonathan Farrow. Ed?
Yeah. Now, some, Denise, are actually talking about ways to step up investing in debt as the economic story unfolds.
Including Christopher Sheldon, co-head of credit and markets at KKR.
Now, he tells Bloomberg's Sonali Basak and Alex Steele, now could be a good time to get ready to snap up some debt. Let's listen in.
Look, I mean, I think we see the economy actually fundamentals declining, but we actually are seeing a lot of interesting opportunity within credit. And if I had to pick one, it's really hard to pick that one. But I'd say there's one area where we're really starting to sort of tell people you need to start striking today, which is deployment into private credit. And that private credit can take all types of forms and structures, but we do think that, you know, having some leadership there and leaning in, just given with the traditional capital markets shut for a while, is a huge opportunity.
Interesting that you say that too, because you do see, if you see what's happening with BCRED, for example, over at Blackstone, there is some nervousness in this market. Why is this the biggest conviction play when investors are worried about a recession, for example, next year, and what that could mean for private credit, which could be very exposed to that part of the economy?
Sure. I mean, I think if you think about it, there's a lot of private equity dollars that were raised in 2021 that will, as M&A starts picking up, will get spent. And I think that without a lot of leadership in the public markets and new issuance there, I think stepping into new transactions, you can be a real leader. And it's a lender market. You're getting real pricing, you're getting real OID, you're getting real structure. And then most importantly, you're getting call protection, which is extending that higher income for longer. And I think that's where the real opportunity, real multiple money is in that extension through call protection.
You're talking about private markets, but what about public markets?
Absolutely. You know, what we're trying to do in the public markets is be that liquidity provider when others are looking for liquidity. On a 50,000 foot level, the market's not for sale, but there's a lot of interesting opportunities and situations that are for sale. And so taking advantage of where the people need liquidity, where there's motivated sellers, where there's motivated need for capital, that could be daily liquidity funds, that could be mismatched assets and liabilities of what we saw at the UK pension during the LDI. It could be sort of refinancings coming up and people need to sort of step in and provide new issuance within the public market.
In that, is it investment grade versus junk bonds? Is it high yield versus leveraged loans? Where are you going to find that kind of upside specifically?
It's idiosyncratic situations. It's company by company. It's subsector by subsector. It's really waiting for those opportunities where people need liquidity rather than necessarily broad-based beta.
You know, I've heard some of your colleagues talk about this idea before about kind of the impossibility here of waiting for the bottom or timing the bottom before you start to get into the market. But even beyond that, do you have a sense of what the bottom is, where spreads really need to go from here, what high yield looks like at the bottom into next year?
Look, timing the bottom is super hard. And I think the market is so fragile right now, where I think waiting is can be a dangerous game. I think starting to strike now is the way you should be thinking about credit. And, you know, if we're at a higher resting heart rate for rates for a long period of time, valuations are going to be lower. Credit seems really attractive relative to equities. And the market essentially is set up almost like a tinderbox ready to explode. So, because when there is consensus, when there is conviction there, a lot of cash is on the sideline that will step in, and there's not a lot to buy. Liquidity is some of the worst we've seen it.
Liquidity is bad. Banks are burned right now for a lot of reasons, but really where the pain really is in the leveraged loan market. How much propensity do you have to buy hung loans at scale?
Look, the hung book is out there. People know it's a pricing exercise on some. It's a credit decision and binary on others. And so really that's one area of the trade where you can actually show some leadership and step in. But there's a lot of other idiosyncratic situations, whether it be people making decisions on certain subsectors or daily liquidity flows that are looking for liquidity that seem to be more equity linked. And so it's not necessarily the hung loan trade. And there's also a lot of refinancings coming up where new issue, and I think you'll see a lot of product go from the syndicated loan market to the high yield bond market. And I think you'll see a lot of product go from the syndicated loan market to the private credit market.
Chris, I hear you on the idiosyncratic parts of all the different areas of the credit market. Is there any way you could give me an idea of either sectors that you feel like will have the best bang for their buck or even regions?
Look, it's contrarian. We like triple C's. I think if you look at the market today and the construct and the structure of the market, there's not a lot of incentives to take risk in the public markets. A lot of the buyer base is restricted on how much triple C they can buy, whether it be CLOs, whether it be insurance companies, whether it be ETF mutual funds, where 55% of the high yield market's double B. And so you're seeing a lot of dispersion in the market, and particularly where you're seeing a lot of dispersion is triple C. And this is triple C's at time of issuance. This is not necessarily deteriorating credit risk. And I don't think you need to reach for risk or stress to actually get really interesting double-digit types of returns in the market today.
And that was Christopher Sheldon, co-head of credit and markets at KKR, with Bloomberg's Shanali Basak and Alex Steele.
And coming up,
Derek Jeter and the former Yankees business of trading cards and other sports collectibles. We'll hear all about it from Jeter himself.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
Now, Denise, interest in sports collectibles has spiked in recent years.
Yeah, it sure has. A lot of investors are pumping cash into new ventures as a result, like Derek Jeter's trading card business, Arena Club.
Now, you know, Arena just reported a $10 million funding round led by M13 Ventures Management.
Yeah, and that means, Ed, that Arena Club's total funding has now climbed to about $20 million.
Wow. Now, okay, here's how Arena works. You can create online showrooms where you can buy, sell, and trade your card collections.
Mm-hmm. And the items are apparently, they get graded, right? And then they can be kept at this central vault. Users receive some kind of digital proof of ownership for their collections.
So QuickTake chief correspondent Jason Kelly sat down with the iconic former New York Yankee and his business partner Brian Lee to ask them about this growing business.
And our Jason Kelly opens here talking to Jeter.
The trading card industry would almost seem like it was a secret society for years.
Right.
And now you're seeing Mickey Mantle cards being sold for, what, $12 million. Yes. So I think now there's just a lot more attention to the industry. And that's why the idea of Arena Club came about.
Let's start with the news. You've got a lot going on with your company. You know, what's happening?
I first met Brian, this was years ago, like I think it's shortly after I retired, and everyone knows the success that he's had in the entrepreneurial world. And we started having a conversation about trading cards. And my parents used to have all of my baseball cards when I was first came up, whether it's minor league cards, rookie year, and we had a flood at our house. So we had a lot of things that were ruined. Mm. A lot of the cards that I had collected. And you know, a lot of times you try to build businesses and, you know, it starts with, does it make sense? And this just made sense to me. And you know, we're excited about Arena Club.
Yeah, we're super excited to join forces here. And the idea was to truly digitize the physical and to create these online showrooms for folks to buy, sell, and trade. We really wanted to bring to life the passion of card shows and card shops and so forth, and have people experience that online 24/7, anytime they want.
So we've seen some interesting sort of twists and turns over the last couple of years, especially with the digital aspect. How does the sort of NFT play into the business case here?
When someone sends in their cards to Arena Club to be vaulted into our system, we digitize it, we put it on blockchain, and you do get we're calling it digital proof of claim. Some people might call it an asset-backed NFT of that card. So it's a digital representation of the physical card.
And so obviously you have a little bit of a different relationship with trading cards. How did you view them sort of coming up as a kid?
Yeah, we've joked about this. I got trading cards just for the gum.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, but that's why we got cards. And I just remember sitting down, you know, I was a big Yankee fan growing up. My grandmother, huge Yankee fan, talking about Babe Ruth cards that she had back in the day. And I just started collecting all the Yankee cards. And then
you know, you have a dream of one day being on one. But look, you talk about having passion for trading cards. Yeah. Brian's that guy.
You know, most kids stop collecting, right? But I just kept collecting in high school, college, law school, young adult, old adult. I'm still collecting today, so, yeah. So it's a lot of fun.
You know, Honest, I think, is probably one of the companies that people know you best for. You know, what do you take from those experiences that you apply here, Brian?
I think throughout my career of being an entrepreneur, I get very passionate about what I work on. And that passion bleeds into the team. It bleeds into the consumers. I think we're definitely building that foundation to build a company that will be around for generations for kids to enjoy.
Where is baseball right now? I mean, it's America's pastime. What needs to happen for baseball next?
Look, baseball in my mind is the greatest sport in the world. But look, you can't kid yourself. The younger generation, they want to see more action. You know, baseball, you can go 15, 20 minutes without seeing a ball in play. And the days of sitting down in the stands and talking to the person to your left and right, those are way gone, right? Now it's people want to be entertained. They're on their phones all the time. So you have to figure out a way to increase the action because it is entertainment. No matter how you look at it, people want to go and they want to be entertained.
I'm just a fan of this sport. It's my favorite sport. Nothing makes me happier than going to a ball game with my son and my family and rooting for my team. I think...
What team is that?
It's the Los Angeles Dodgers. Sorry, Derek.
That's all right.
That was former New York Yankee Derek Jeter and his business partner, Brian Lee, with Quick Take chief correspondent Jason Kelly about Jeter and Hall's new sports collectibles business, Arena Club.
And that is it for this edition of Bloomberg Best.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
And this is Bloomberg.